Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, and thanks for listening. If you've been meaning to call, this would be a good time because we do have, amazingly, a line or two open right now. So you won't get a busy signal, but if you wait, you probably will. So call 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We'll get over to Sylmar, California now and talk to Aurora. Hi, Aurora.
Good morning. Oh, I'm so glad I'm talking to you. Thanks for all you do. I have a question about transfiguration. Why did Jesus choose Elijah or Moses? Or why didn't he choose Abraham? And what is the significance of Elijah and Moses in the transfiguration? I don't understand that.
Okay, I can help. So Moses and Elijah are the personification of the law and the prophets, respectively. So Moses is the personification of the law that God gave, the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic ceremonial law, animal sacrifice and all that. And Elijah is the personification of all the prophets. So the purpose of them being there, it seems, is to demonstrate to the apostles that Jesus is the Lord over the law and the prophets. He supersedes these magnificent figures of old, Moses and Elijah, as important and as authoritative as they were. They, it is shown to the apostles, are inferior to Jesus. Jesus is their Lord too. So it's also a way of demonstrating by this transfigurement. Now, I don't claim to have plumbed the depths of every reason that Jesus chose Moses and Elijah, or to fully understand all the ramifications of the transfiguration. There are scholars to this day who are still plumbing the depths of that reality. But we can say, though, that Jesus is also bringing together the law and the prophets and the persons of Moses and Elijah in the Old Testament. And you notice that he's bringing them into direct contact with the authorities of the New Covenant, which would be the apostles and their successors, the bishops. So there are multiple layers of meaning here, but for themselves personally, they represent the law and the prophets. That's what's going on there.
Oh, okay. Because I went to Holy Land last month, and we went to the Mount of Transfiguration, and I couldn't understand the fact that, you know, Elijah and Moses appeared. Now I kind of know. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much what you do, Patrick.
Thank you. This is a loaded question, and I think I know the answer. Did you find your life changed by going to the Holy Land on that pilgrimage?
You know, when I touched the stone of the tomb, it brings tears to my eyes, you know. I don't know why. I was so emotional.
Well, I know why, because you were walking and seeing in the very places where Jesus and Mary were all those years ago.
Yeah.
You'll never read the Bible the same way now, will you, now that you've been there?
No. No. And it kind of bring my faith deeper. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened. So thanks a lot for what you do.
You're welcome, Aurora. Thank you. Nice chatting with you. Yes, as Aurora said, the impact of going on a pilgrimage is huge. And even just something as simple as how you read the Bible and being able to visualize, in some cases, what the place looks like, where Jesus was, let's say on the north shore of Galilee, and where he fed the thousands of people with just a few loaves of bread and few fish. And you know, the miracle, of course, is that he fed them super abundantly. There was more than enough to go around. And you can go to the place where that happened. It's right there. You can see it for yourself, or see the place where Jesus said to the apostles, "Who do men say that I am?" Well, some say John the Baptist or Elijah or one of the prophets. Yes, but who do you say that I am? That took place, and you read about it in Matthew chapter 16, that took place in an area called Caesarea Philippi. And you'll see the place where Jesus said this. And the place itself, scholars may dispute whether or not, you know, was it this place or that place. I think all the evidence that I have looked at is strongly supportive of the fact that it was at this place that Jesus said this to his apostles, because one of the features of this area is a huge rock. It's like a giant rock cliff that looms up out of the ground. And I don't know how high it is, maybe 200 feet, 100 feet at least, something like that. And it was at that place that Jesus says, you know, upon this rock, referring to Simon Peter, I will build my church. There's a big cave as you look at this giant rock cliff. It's really sort of like almost like Half Dome in at Yosemite, but it's not that big. But you have this sheer face, and there are niches. You can still see them carved into the face of this rock. And this is where the idols for, previously it would be Pan, because the town was known as Panias. It was dedicated to this Greek false god Pan. You know, Mr. Tumnus, that guy from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, something like that. Half goat, half man. And then when Philip the Tetrarch, one of the Herod boys, when he gained control of this area, he wanted to curry favor with Imperial Rome, so he renamed the town from Panias to Caesarea Philippi, or Philippi, as it's sometimes called. It's not properly pronounced that way, but most people say it that way. And he did so because he wanted to flatter the Roman emperor. Hey, this is a town, you know, for you, from me. And it was at that point that, because of the Roman tendency to worship the Caesars as gods, they removed the idol of Pan, and they replaced it with an idol of Caesar, which very likely was there in at least one of these niches at the time when Jesus and the apostles are there. So you have this blasphemous idol that is sitting, and it may well also have been, there are indications that there may have been a shrine built on the top of this rock. It's no longer there, but it appears as though there may have been some structure there. And as you look directly at this giant rock face of this hill, this giant rock, you see at the lower left this large, dark, mysterious cave. And the ceiling of the cave is, I don't know, like 20, 30 feet up, maybe higher. And this cave was known by the ancient peoples long before the time of Jesus, but certainly by the time of Jesus, it was known as one of the gates of Sheol. That may ring a bell for you, the gates of hell, the gates of Sheol. So we say the word hell in English, but Sheol was the Hebrew word, Hades was the Greek word. And the reason that the local people thought that this was one of the doorways into the underworld was because they tried many times over the centuries to figure out just how deep these holes in the ground would go. And they would tie large rocks to ropes and then lower them down, you know, as far as they had ropes to go down, and they could never hit the bottom. And so that was one feature of this mysterious cave, which they called the Gates of Sheol. And another, interesting feature was that it is one of the sources of the headwaters of the River Jordan. And you can see, even to this day, rushing water that's coming out from the base of this rock. And all of these things were there when Jesus and his apostles were told they were in the district of Caesarea Philippi. Now, that doesn't preclude the fact that they might have been in the town itself, as opposed to some distance from it. But in any case, it was in this location. When you go to the Holy Land, you can go there. I've taken pilgrimage groups to the Holy Land. This is one of the places we go. And you can see the spectacular symbolism in what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 16. Who do men say that I am? Well, some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah or one of the prophets. Well, who do you say that I am? You, my trusted disciples, my inner circle. You've been with me now for a year and a half, 2 years, thereabouts. You've seen the miracles. You've heard me preach. You know me personally. Who do you say that I am? And Simon says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, you are blessed, Simon, son of Jonah, for no mere man has revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven has revealed this to you. Therefore, I say to you, you are rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And I will give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. Now he's speaking in the singular form to Peter himself. In Matthew 18:18, he'll say almost the same words to all the apostles as a group. But here he's speaking just to Peter. Peter, Simon, gets a name change. And what's interesting is that this name change is not to an actual name. Petros is the masculinized form of a feminine noun, the feminine noun for rock, Petra. And so even that is a little bit odd, to change a feminine noun to a masculine form, Petros, and furthermore, to use that as a name. Kepha was the word in Aramaic. Sometimes you see it as Kephas or Cephas. Sometimes you'll see it transliterated in the Gospels. And that Aramaic word means rock. And Jesus tells Simon in John chapter 1, when he first meets him, he says, your name is Simon, but you will be called Kepha. And that Aramaic word is translated into Greek as Petros. It's given a masculine ending so that it wouldn't sound weird, you know, like calling a man Roxanne or some feminine sounding name. That wouldn't do. So when it was translated from Aramaic Kepha into Greek, it was translated as Petros. Jesus didn't speak Greek to them in that place. He probably did speak Greek, but he wasn't speaking Greek to them there. He was speaking Aramaic. You are Kepha, and upon this Kepha I will build my church. Now, what is that thing looming in the background? It's a big rock. It's a big giant cliff. And what is on that cliff? A shrine to a false god. Dare I say a church, although the term church would not have been used in that context about a shrine like that. But you have this structure that is housing an idol to a false god. And so Jesus seems to be using this by way of analogy to say, upon this rock, Kepha, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Why would he say the gates of hell? Because as you look at this big mysterious cave and the water that's rushing out, it's a wonder to me that all that water coming out from beneath this rocky mound didn't eventually erode the foundation to the point where it would collapse. That's the thought that came to my mind the very first time I saw it. Like over all these eons of time, thousands of years, and all this rushing water, why didn't it basically pulverize the foundation and the rock would collapse? I mean, it's just a natural formation, it's all, but that comes to my mind. So when Jesus said, and the gates of hell will not prevail against his church, so he's talking about himself as the true God in the church that he is establishing on this rock, Kepha, it's magnificent. And there's much more that one can say about all that. So the reason I'm riffing on this issue is because, as Aurora was saying, that by going to the Holy Land, she really experienced a dramatic increase in how she reads the Bible. I guess I'm putting words into her mouth, but I'm sure she would agree with me. So those are the kinds of things that when you, if ever you'd get a chance to go, if ever you do go, these are the kinds of things that when you see them, then you think, oh, now I get it. Now I see why Jesus said that, or now I see where he said this. I'll give you another example. So in the feeding of the 5,000 people, or the 10,000 people, it seems that there were multiple times, at least two, that this happened. But in any case, thousands and thousands of men, women, and children were gathered on the grassy hillside to hear Jesus preach. And one of the things that, if you're just reading this straight from Scripture and you haven't been there, when Jesus says to the apostles, give the people something to eat. Remember when he says that? Give the people something to eat. When you go there, suddenly that phrase will jump out at you because this is in the middle of nowhere. It's on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. It's barren. there are hardly any trees to be seen anywhere. And whatever trees are there or you know, have been planted in recent generations, or at least in the recent hundreds of years. But in those days, it was basically a big, empty, desolate area. And that's why the apostles say, Lord, where will we find enough food to feed all these people in this desolate place? They ask him this question. Now, almost, you can almost hear their eyes rolling. Lord, what are you talking about? What do you mean feed all these people? Let's send them home. Let's send them back to where they came from, because there ain't no food in this area. That's what makes this passage come alive when you see it, because you realize this was the it seems to me, this is the reason why Jesus chose that place for this miracle, because there was no way, humanly speaking, that all of these folk could have food enough to eat their fill and have 12 wicker baskets of food left over. That was heightening the glory of this beautiful miracle because of the desolation of that place. So it's things like that. Well, we have other phone calls to get to, and we will do that on the other side of this quick timeout. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Coming right back to your phone calls. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. The Relevant Radio Studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Flexible Premium Life Insurance. For less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's good stuff, Cyrus.
Nobody,
I like
likes,
it when Christmas comes and we can
nobody
roll
likes
out these
it more
songs.
Than young Thomas.
He's tapping his toes, I can see.
Yep,
hand him some maracas.
He's dancing. Sit down and get back to work, Thomas.
Yeah. Hand him some maracas. We get a little accompaniment. 888-914-9149. It's not technically the Christmas season yet, but we're real close. Still in Advent, though. The birth of baby Jesus is not far away. Are you ready? You ready to celebrate?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
I am ready. I'm anxiously ready. Looking forward to it.
My kids were ready 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, and I had to put the kibosh on it and say, no Christmas decorations until after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It's a rule. And I'm not budgeting.
Yeah. Well, tell that to the retailers.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel sorry for
by
the
Labor
people
Day,
working.
They've got the Christmas decorations
And
up.
They're so sick of the music, and it's too bad.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm really, really, really ready for? Is to not be woken up by little kids at 6 a.m. Dad, can we go see what's under the tree? For many years, that was that
your
was
kids
part
sleep
of our...
in till 6 a.m. on Christmas morning. Wow, you're lucky.
Well, I know it's. I guess they're different that way. But back when all of our kids were little, you know, and living at home, that was the thing. You just knew you're going to be up at the crack of dawn, and those kids want to get out there and see what's under the tree. And since they've all grown up, that's not a problem anymore. Because number one, I know what's under the tree. We know exactly what's under the tree. And, you know, we can take our time before we go out and do that part of it. But, you know, getting to Mass and all the festivities surrounding the birth of Jesus and all that means, the Christmas tree is, you know, distant second to all that. But when the time comes and you're there celebrating with family and the beauty of the day, it's priceless. And we have lots of great memories. And eventually, Cyrus, once your kids are grown up and grown out, you'll have a lot of those great memories too.
Are you okay with the Christmas tree going up after Thanksgiving, or do you think it should wait?
Personally, I think that it's, and I always lose this battle every year. I lobby for the tree to go up maybe no earlier than, say, 2 weeks before Christmas. But I always lose that battle. I won't say to whom. Not going to mention any names. Wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. But I lose that battle, and the tree winds up going up earlier than that. But definitely not before Thanksgiving, no.
All right. Yep. Same. Yep. That's a battle I lose. Except the Thanksgiving's the hard line. I'm not budging.
That's your red line?
It is my red line.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's good, because obviously we don't want to dilute the season of Advent, because the season of Advent is not the same as the season of Christmas. The season of Christmas begins on Christmas Eve. And the season of Advent, which is that preparation for the birth of Jesus, takes place those 4 weeks before that. So we want to at least do justice to the fact that that season, we don't want it to get swallowed up in the celebration of Christmas before the time comes. It'd be like, you wouldn't want to celebrate your birthday 6 weeks before your birthday.
I don't want to celebrate my birthday on my birthday.
The older you get, the more you'll feel that way.
Yeah, I'm feeling it. That's why when it's your birthday, I love just bombarding you with birthday stuff.
I know you do.
It's so fun.
It shows. That's why whenever my birthday falls on a weekend, I feel like I've got a win.
That's the real gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, because Cyrus can't do that. Hey, I have an idea. Let's take some phone calls. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Anna now in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Anna. Happy Advent.
Good morning. Good morning, Patrick. I'm back at you. My question is, and I'll be very brief. If I go to communion to a priest that I know literally knows something that is so terribly wrong, that is a mortal sin, is it affecting me, or should I just change parishes? Because I feel like if I'm taking communion from someone that is not in the state of grace himself, am I committing a sin?
No. Let's start there. So not only are you not committing a sin, you are in no way deprived of the fullness of the spiritual fruits of that sacrament. So let's say that this priest, objectively speaking, is in the state of serious sin. When he celebrates Mass and he confects the Holy Eucharist and you receive Holy Communion, it is no different, it's no less powerful or any of those things coming from the hands of a priest who's in the state of mortal sin than it would be if you received it from St. Padre Pio himself. You do not in any way lack the benefits of that sacrament. His sin can't diminish the sacrament, is the point. So his sin is between him and the Lord. And if he isn't going to confession for whatever reason, that's between him and the Lord, and it doesn't exonerate him, but it in no way is transferable to you, and you're not committing a sin in any way whatsoever.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. It's such a dilemma in my life right now. I don't know what to do, and I really thought, because I know for fact, so now you've set my mind at ease that I am not in any way.
No. You don't do anything wrong when you receive, because let's face it, most people would have no clue about what's going on in the life of somebody else. Now, if for some reason you do know, I don't need to know how you know, but if you do know, you can just put that thought out of your mind, pray for him, obviously, and hope that he gets right with the Lord. But in the meantime, if he is dispensing the sacraments, his sin has no effect on the power and the grace of those sacraments.
Oh, okay then. Well, thank you very much, sir, for your time. And it does set my mind at ease. Thank you very much.
I'm glad, Anna. And that's the name of the game, isn't it? To know where things stand. Thanks, Anna. Just by way of a little editorial footnote here, St. Augustine had to go through a lot of trouble with a heretical group in his day. Keep in mind, he was born in the year 354, so only about 300 years after the time of Jesus. And the world in which he lived and the church that he was a bishop in was extremely similar in many respects to the church as it was in the time of the apostles and immediately after that. And he had to deal with, among other heresies, the heresy of Donatism. And one of the features of the Donatist heresy was this notion, which is false, and St. Augustine had to do a Mexican hat dance on this over and over again. The Donatists, as a result of some of the persecutions of the church in northern Africa, they were the ones who were scandalized by clergy, primarily clergy in northern Africa, who they regarded as traitors, traditores in Latin, which we translate as traitors. And they said these traitors, when the soldiers knocked at the rectory door and said, give us your Bible and give us the sacred vessels and whatever other stuff you've got in that church, give it to us because we're confiscating it. And in some cases, they did that. They handed it over rather than be killed. Or they themselves might have apostatized and denied Jesus so that they wouldn't be killed, only to repent later after the persecution had died down. And other things like that. So the Donatists, one of their problems was they fell into this notion to think that these bishops and priests who were reinstated, even though they were cowards in some fashion during the persecutions, they were reinstated. They said, their sacraments are not valid because they're in the state of sin, serious sin. So their baptisms aren't valid, their Eucharist is not valid, etc. And so St. Augustine had to rear up on his hind legs and stomp all over that bad notion because it's not true. And he had to painstakingly refute this idea that the sinfulness of a priest, for example, in any way diminished or negated the power of God's grace in the sacrament. That was the whole essence of this controversy that he had with the Donatists. Now, Donatism has been dead and buried for a very long time, but in a certain way, it sort of rears its ugly head again now and then in the concern that some people understandably have, but we should put their fears to rest. Their concern, without knowing the church's teaching on this issue, thinking that, oh gosh, well, if the priest is in the state of serious sin, then like Anna was saying a moment ago, you know, am I committing a sin when I receive Holy Communion from a priest who's in sin? And St. Augustine's answer is a resounding no, you're not committing a sin. In fact, you're receiving a valid sacrament, and that's because God's grace is more powerful than our sin. So the sinfulness or the virtue of the priest who's celebrating Mass, to give you an example, or hearing your confession, or baptizing your baby, has nothing to do, one way or the other, with the power and the effects of the sacraments. That's what Jesus does. He is in the sacrament, and his power, sacramentally, is what is accomplishing these good things in your life, notwithstanding the sinfulness of the minister who might be giving you that sacrament. This is worth, every so often, this is a topic that's worth revisiting, because there may be any number of other people who may have that nagging doubt. And if that describes you, please push that doubt out of your mind. And St. Augustine's going to give you two big thumbs up. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Dustin now in Sacramento. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Patrick. I'm just going to ask my question and hang up because I know there's a bit of a time crunch, and I know I'm on a time crunch and I have to go be in work in 20 minutes. But anyway.
Fair enough.
So some time ago, I bought a book that was against God and religion and everything, just so I could rip it up and throw it away. But I didn't want anybody else to be reading that book. Yeah. And I was wondering if during that, I displeased God in any way, maybe when the actual fact of buying the book, maybe. And thank you.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, reading your book.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
And by the way, I'm halfway done with reading your book, Inquisition.
Oh, I hope you're enjoying it, and I hope you don't tear it up when you're done.
Oh, definitely not.
Thank you. Well, to your question, Dustin, you don't have to hang up if you don't want to. No, I don't think that you committed a sin. You were zealous and hot-headed for the things of God, and you were offended by the fact that this book was blaspheming God or denying God, whatever it may have been. Now, the one thing to remember, especially in this market economy that we're in, when you bought the book, I presume you bought it from Amazon or you bought it at a bookstore, or whatever, the way things work is when they see that this book sold, that automatically is going to order another book because they say, oh, this one sold. Maybe other people will buy it. So that's an unintended side effect. I mean, you didn't intend that that should happen, but that's one of the ways that these books will be ordered more. So even though you took that book out of circulation, the replacement copy is on its way and it'll be on the shelf in due time. That's just an unavoidable reality in the kind of commercial system that we live in. So next time you have this desire, just think about that as well.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen because the bookstore I bought it from, that I got it, that mm-hmm. started, was one of those stores in which you donate books to be sold.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's not as though their ordering system is going to order another copy of that because these are like onesies, twosies, whatever book they have in stock, it's because somebody donated it, right?
Right.
Yeah. So in that case, that makes perfect sense to me that you don't want the contagion of bad ideas to spread any further. So if you bought that book so that it doesn't wind up harming somebody else, yeah, sure.
Which I will admit, I'm surprised that I actually did that because I have a great respect for books. I love books. I love to read. And mm-hmm. to me, ripping a book, any book up would be equivalent to ripping up a Bible. It's just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some books that deserve to be ripped up because they're either blasphemous or they're proposing some kind of serious error. And there's nothing wrong in trying to eliminate something that's dangerous. Now, I don't buy into, and I'm not suggesting that we should do book burnings or anything like that, because obviously that gets into an ideology of anti-intellectualism or fear of other ideas. My view is that whatever the opposing view may be, if it's opposing the truth can hold its own in open combat, and that people should be able to see the superiority, let's say, of the case for the existence of God over above the bankrupt worldview of atheism, which is indefensible intellectually, if you ask me. You know, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins notwithstanding. So there's a time and place for these clash of ideas to be publicly seen so that people can see that we have the superior worldview as theists. But at the same time, just like you wouldn't leave sharp objects around where little kids are around, or you wouldn't leave possible deadly poisons where little kids could get to it, we have to have a kind of prudence. It's not that we should always just tolerate error in all its forms in all cases, because some kind of error, people who are maybe less learned or more simple or young are more susceptible to being harmed ideologically by these things. So we want to do what we can to make sure that they're not harmed. But at the same time, recognize that these ideas, these notions, they must be refuted. And to be refuted publicly where everybody can see them refuted is important. So no, I don't endorse book burnings, but I do agree that from time to time you have to remove something from harm's way so that people aren't injured by it. Give you an example.
Like the time when
I go in, if I may, Dustin, when I go into the post office from time to time, I'll see these little chick comic book tracts. And the chick tracts are, they've been around for, I don't know, 60, 70 years, something like that. Now, there's little lurid comic books that often, they're not all anti-Catholic, but many of them are. And they're just scurrilous and dumb, but they're effective because people read them. It's very simple. You've got these comic book pictures, tells a story, and there are many gullible people whose opinions about the faith have been badly damaged because they read a stupid chick comic book tract. So when I'm in a public place like a post office, and if I see one of these things, sure, I'll tear it up and throw it away because I don't want the next person to get it and maybe be harmed by it. Which is, it sounds to me like that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, and actually that reminded me of another time in a Barnes & Noble. I didn't buy or rip any books from them, but I found a book on witchcraft mixed in with a religion, and that greatly upset me, and I told the one of the store clerks about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good for you, Dustin. standing up for what's right. I mean, we obviously don't want to do anything illegal or anything harmful or anything like that, but we should be prudent in how we go about that. I appreciate the phone call, Dustin. I have to take a quick time out. And I think I've shared this story before. In fact, I know I have. But when we come back, I'll share a quick story from my own life. It didn't have to do with me. It had to do with my dad and something he did in a similar kind of situation that I've never forgotten. And I'll tell you what that is on the other side of this quick timeout. 888-914-9149. My dad did something kind of like that, but different. And I'll tell you what happened right after this. I don't know. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Let me tell you what happened. I was about, as I recall, I don't know, around about 12, 13 years old, somewhere in there. And we had a family tradition, which I loved. After church on Sunday, invariably, we would hit one of the donut shops in town. And I don't know if this is like universal, but in Southern California, where I grew up, the donuts came in a big pink box, because we would order like a dozen or dozen and a half or two dozen, whatever it was. And one store that we would stop at from time to time, I don't think they had donuts there, but they did have like sub sandwiches. They had like a deli counter there. And so sometimes we'd get donuts, sometimes we'd get sub sandwiches, sometimes we'd get donuts and sub sandwiches. Those were always my favorite Sundays. So there was this store, and back in the day, early 70s. I think the store was called La Vicio's. And it was probably owned by, you know, someone from the old country. And so we would from time to time stop there and get some sandwiches and then go home and have a nice lunch. Well, one day we went in there, and I often would go into the store with my dad, and I would help carry stuff or I would help pick out whatever. And this particular time, there was a brand new big magazine rack filled with, let's just say, bad magazines. My dad lights up like a Christmas tree, and I see this, and I'm his eyes, you know, like, what? So he proceeds to go over to the counter, and he demands to speak to the owner or the manager, I forget now. And the guy behind the counter says, I'm the owner. And my dad says, why do you have these bad magazines in your store? I come in here and look, my kids are in here with me. I don't want them to see this stuff. You need to get rid of those magazines. So the guy, the owner, he gets his back up. He's not going to be talked to this way. I will not be dictated to. And so he pushes back against my dad. And my dad says, I'm not going to shop here anymore if you keep these magazines in here. And I'm just like this kid standing there watching my dad light this guy up. I was kind of enjoying it.
Aibo! Aibo!
Exactly. So my dad storms out, me in tow. No sandwiches, by the way. And the guy behind the counter, he's steaming because he didn't like being told off by my dad. And my dad said, I'm not going to come here anymore, and I'm going to tell everybody I know not to come into your store. Because the guy was like, yeah, don't come here anymore. I don't care. Don't let the door hit you on the way out kind of thing. You don't scare me, Mr. Father of eight kids. I don't care if you don't ever come here again kind of thing. So my dad says, yeah, well, I'm going to tell everyone I know. I'm going to tell everyone I know not to come to your store because of these bad magazines. So we got in the car, and that's about all I remember. I wish I could remember the ensuing conversation that he had with my mom once we got back in the car. Anyway, long story short, I don't know how much time went by. And my dad would always call the store La Vicio's. And my mom would say, it's lascivios. And it would be just an absent-minded kind of thing. But he would call it lascivios, which is kind of perfect because a lascivious person is the kind of person who would read those lascivious magazines. In any case, for some reason, my dad decided to check that store out again some months later. And what does he find? No more bad magazines. Because, as the old saying goes, money talks. And he did, and my mom did too, as I recall, told, you know, all the people at the parish and anybody who would listen, this is a store. Yeah, they've got great sandwiches, but they also sell pornographic magazines. So don't go in there. We're not going in there anymore, kind of thing. And apparently it reached critical mass and enough people stopped going there that the guy pulled the magazines out and they weren't there.
Aibo! Aibo! Knockout!
Yes.
Game over, man. It's game over.
Isn't that great, Cyrus?
I love that story.
I love telling it because I was just this, you know, dork, four-eyed dork standing there watching my dad lead the charge, and it was kind of cool.
Money talks. You know, if you don't like something, stop buying it.
Yeah.
Stop frequenting that store.
And if you can get enough people to follow suit, you know, that does affect the bottom line. And when the bottom line is sagging, companies will say, what are we doing wrong here? So just a thought. I've never forgotten that story. That's 50 years ago that happened. Anyway, 888-914-9149. Let's go to, where are we going to go? Rose in Chicago. Hi, Rose.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for your witness and Relevant Radio. My question is, I have a godson. He's 28 years old now, and I was very close to him when he was young. But mm-hmm. after 21, you know, life took over, and he has been living with a young girl for the past 3 years. Actually, they got their own apartment. Then he went and got her parents allowed them to live in their house, too. But now I receive an announcement. It's not an official invitation to the wedding, but it's like it's announcing that there will be a date. And there's like three different categories. One is the ceremony, which will be non-denominational. I don't know what kind of minister they'll have or if it is a minister. The second one is then there will be cocktails. And then the third, they give you three different hours. Now, I don't know how to respond to that because, you know, I'm his godmother for baptism, and he's kind of rejected everything about the faith, doesn't, you know, take anything serious anymore, and he's living a high lifestyle, you know, because her parents are kind of wealthy. And so now how do I respond in a godly way? So that I can give a good example because of my faith that, you know, I want to do the right thing. So I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that it's come to this, but, you know, as his godmother, you're doing the right thing by trying to do what you can to try to help him. If he rebuffs everything, then, you know, that's on him, sadly. But you could write him a letter. Mm-hmm. You know, I love you. I care about you. I want you to be happy, and I wish I could support you in doing this. I'd like to be able to support you, but as a Catholic, you have the obligation to get married in the church. And if you did that, and if you were to get permission from the bishop to do this, and maybe a priest could be there at the non-denominational service, bishops will permit that, mm-hmm. then I can go and support you, and I'd love to support you. Would it be possible that you could ask for the parish priest to be there to give you the blessing of the church at this non-denominational wedding? And he might just say, well, yeah, we could do that. Mm-hmm. So my thought here is rather than approach him with a rebuke, because that never goes over well, approach him with a, hey, I have an idea. Couldn't we do this? And maybe he would say, okay, we can do that. And you could help him in that regard so that he would have a valid marriage, all other things being equal, and you could be there to celebrate. And who knows, maybe there might be some breakthrough where mm-hmm. as time goes by, he might be more receptive to your ideas mm-hmm. about the church. That's one mm-hmm. creative way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that would be good, Patrick. Yeah. If he, you know, decides not to, then where do I, what do I have to, you know, I mean, do I go to this ceremony? Do I just go to the dinner? You know,
he's a lapsed Catholic, right? He was Catholic. He received all the sacraments.
Catholic. He was going to church. He was an usher at church with his father. Okay. And after, you know, I'd say, like I said, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know, he just got, you know, more involved in this other lifestyle. And I don't know, you know,
shacking up with this,
I was very
this
close
lady?
To him before.
Is that the lifestyle you're talking about?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You said he got caught up in this lifestyle, and I was just wondering, are you talking about shacking up with this lady or some other lifestyle?
Yes, yes. You met the girl. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. Well, obviously, it's a delicate situation, and you're clearly doing the best you can. You're trying to be tactful and gracious and loving, and that's great. I would say continue to do that. Show the love of Jesus. But as far as attending the wedding, I mean, he is a Catholic. Once a Catholic, always a Catholic. He's received the sacraments of initiation. He's obliged by the church's law to get married according to the canonical form, which includes getting married in a Catholic church and having that marriage witnessed by either a Catholic priest, could be a deacon or a bishop. Now, if he were willing to get a dispensation from his bishop, and bishops do grant dispensations like this, then you could in good conscience attend the wedding itself and even, you know, the festivities afterward. Because if he receives permission from the bishop to do this, and it might entail, for example, having a priest there at this ceremony, as I said, to bless the wedding, there is a pathway through this where you can be there to support him. But if it came down to it and he says, nope, I'm not interested in what the Catholic Church has to say, well, then you have an objectively invalid marriage. And in that case, I don't see how you or I could go there and celebrate, quote-unquote, something that's seriously sinful for him. Mm-hmm. Because as a Catholic, he has that obligation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I agree. I think that would be the, you know, the answer, too. So I'm hoping, you know, that by prayers and sacrifices, maybe this will come true, that he can, you know, see where God's plan is for his life. So that's mm-hmm. what I'm hoping for. But
maybe you can give him a great gift called Three to Get Married by Fulton Sheen. And mm-hmm. it's a book on marriage. And the third person mm-hmm. in the marriage, of course, is God. And God mm-hmm. is at the center mm-hmm. of this. And that might speak to him if he's willing mm-hmm. to read it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was even thinking of what would be a good wedding gift to give them, you know, like a Bible, you know, instead of, you know, a monetary gift, mm-hmm. something that represents his faith, even if he should reject, you know, and I would respond by giving a gift, even maybe if I didn't attend, you know, what would be, I mean, would a Bible be good or...
I love the Bible. It's a good gift. I'm guessing if they're in a non-denominational church, she's probably non-denominational. And mm-hmm. if that's the case, she probably has a Bible. Maybe he doesn't have one. I mean, mm-hmm, you can never mm-hmm. go wrong with giving a Bible to somebody. That's always a good thing to do. If you wanted to make more of a statement, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you could give him a copy of the Bible and a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church so mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. he might thumb mm-hmm. through that and begin mm-hmm. to learn a few things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That would be good. Mm-hmm.
Just a thought.
So I hope. I hope, because this is a time of the year, you know, for Christmas and everything where, you know, things get a little bit more, you know, commercial. And I, you know, received this announcement like 3 days ago. And I'm thinking, well, how can I incorporate the season with this invitation? So maybe bringing this all together now at this time of the year, responding and giving, you know, your suggestion, maybe... maybe that'll have some kind of, you know, insight, you know, where he can feel more inspired to do the right thing.
Maybe. He's got a great godmother. I know that much for sure, Rose. So keep on keeping on. And we'll say a little prayer for him that he'll get his life back on track, God willing. I'll be right back. Hour 3 is about to start right after this.